So as I said, what we've done here is we've taken first some of the work that we've done in the past with our 2010 report on New York City's public financing system and some interviews that we did with candidates to talk to them about their incentives and really how the New York City public financing system changed their incentives and encouraged them to reach out to small donors, to donors within their own communities, rather than targeting the same wealthy few whom they might otherwise depend on to fund their campaigns. And they told us that that's exactly what they were doing. So to give you just a couple of quotes, we had one four-time city council member say that regular New Yorkers who never thought of contributing now get excited about doing so. They don't feel dwarfed by big money interests. And again, the reason why that happens, what everyone has been talking about here today, is that there's a match. People's money is amplified, or their voices amplified through the matching system. And of course, we had City Council Member Jumani Williams say that his opponents had access to big money in a way that he didn't, but that matching funds helped him keep up with them in fundraising, and that the availability of those funds makes it absolutely easier for someone like him, a non-traditional candidate, someone who doesn't have connections and money from the establishment, to run for office in New York and ultimately to prevail in his campaign. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to take these propositions and go further with them and see if we can illustrate them. And in order to do so, we had great collaboration, very kind support from Professor Malbin and his colleagues at the Campaign Finance Institute, who gave us their data from the 2009 city council elections that allowed us to really graphically illustrate through maps of New York City, a city that we know, who is actually giving the money. We talked about the numbers of small donors and how there's a paradigm shift, in Professor Malbin's terms, to the participation of small donors, but we didn't talk about where they come from. And that was the enterprise that we undertook here to take that data. And I want to just say thank you. I know that there's a former colleague of Professor Malbin's who's here today, who was very instrumental in producing that data, Peter Brusso. So thank you so much to him. We took that data, we created some maps that we wanted to share with you today. So the first map that I want to show you, this is a map of New York City block groups in which individual donors gave over $1,000. So what you're looking at here in red is any block group in which a donor, at least one donor, gave over $1,000. And it may not shock you to learn there are not many such block groups. Most of the map is empty. The sort of yellowish part of the map is a place where no one could afford to give that money. And so you'll see very heavy representation on Manhattan's Upper East and Upper West Side. I won't try to name all of the places, but you can see how heavily concentrated those areas are and that they correlate very closely with predominantly wealthy, predominantly white neighborhoods in New York City. Then we moved down quite substantially, we thought, to donors over $175. And again, you're looking at the same thing. You're looking at either no donors at all over $175 or at least one donor who gave over that amount. And you're seeing that there's significant improvement, certainly, from 1,000 to this point, but you still see a lot of parts of the map where there's no representation at all, where no one was able to give over $175. And again, without trying to name all of them, you see significant parts of Queens and Brooklyn, of Upper Manhattan, and particularly the Bronx, where no one was able to give over $175 to a candidate. And then, of course, we looked at donations between $1 and $175, and now you see a totally different map. You basically see New York City the way that we actually see it in real life, where only the uninhabited portions of New York City are not colored in, and so you have somebody giving money from every block group, basically, where people live. And I think the reason to pause here and the reason to think about this again, and this goes back to what you've heard the other panelists say, is that this is not a foregone conclusion. It's not just that there are smaller donations and so more people can afford to give them, and so you have a map that looks like this. Without candidates reaching out to small donors and mobilizing their constituents and saying, we want to be funded by the people we want to serve, people wouldn't be incentivized to give even what they might be able to afford to give. So this map and the kind of representation of participation in the political process that it represents is really made possible by New York City's program. So this map is a little bit more complicated visually, but it does make a little bit of a distinct point. What we did here is instead of just focusing on the binary question of whether at least one person gave or no person gave between $1 and $175, we actually broke the numbers apart and looked at how many donors gave within each census block group. And so we started with blue. Here, blue is zero. And we sort of ratcheted up the intensity of the colors from light green to yellow to orange to red. And red represents the most donations in a single block group. And what I think this illustrates that the other map doesn't is, you know, you could have looked at the other map and said, well, yes, but maybe it was just one person giving in every single one of those census block groups, and that wouldn't be very compelling. But what this shows you is that there actually are tremendous swaths of New York City, including, as we'll get to in a moment, areas that have a lot of low-income residents and a lot of residents who are minorities who are giving in really substantial numbers. And that is something that, again, is very much unique and a testament to New York City's system and the way it incentivizes candidates to reach out all over the map in the way that we see here. So I just want to focus on what it means to get this kind of coverage all over New York City. I think traditionally when we hear donors, unfortunately our association is donors are high-powered people. They're people who have a lot of money. That's what we hear in the media. That's what we see in our culture. And so it's really important to think about who are these folks all over the map. Again, as I just showed you, we're giving. And so this is a map that that really illustrates the distribution of voting age residents in New York City who are living at or below the federal poverty line. And I think one thing that it really illustrates is how concentrated low-income residents are in New York, how heavily concentrated they are in just in certain areas. And so when you see representation and significant representation in that prior map, those two prior maps of donors from those areas, that's really telling you that candidates are reaching out to constituents where they live and getting contributions and getting support and participation in low-income areas as well as the traditional bases of political donors. And so we didn't just look at low-income communities, we also looked at race, and we looked at the distribution of different racial minorities throughout New York City. Here, you see the African-American population, and in a second I'll show you the Hispanic population and also the Asian population in New York City. And one thing that really struck me as I was looking at this map is that New York City continues to be segregated to a very large extent. And you know, you can't walk away from the map when you see that. It's very apparent. And again, you know, you see heavy concentrations of black residents in parts of Brooklyn and Queens and obviously in Upper Manhattan and the Bronx, and I'm not including all the areas, but you'll see that they're really clustered together in certain communities. And again, when we look at the map that shows the kinds of participation rates that we've seen all over New York City, including in all these areas, that is something that is very different from what you see among traditional donors and what you see when candidates are only incentivized to go to the Upper East Side or the Upper West Side for their wealthy donors. And I won't belabor the point, but I'll show you here the maps of Hispanic residents in New York City. Again, you'll see the same thing, that when candidates are targeting donors in their own communities, they're really reaching out to all of these different people who look like New York City looks and not like the wealthy donors look. And the same here is true of New York City's Asian residents. So we didn't stop there. We actually did a kind of a focus or a close-up on certain parts of New York City, and I'll just kind of quickly show you what we got by doing that. So this is not all of Brooklyn. This is part of Brooklyn that covers Bedford-Stuyvesant and some of Bushwick and Crown Heights, and we know this to be, you know, heavily African-American area. We also know it to be an area where there are a lot of residents who are at or below the poverty line. And this is what we see when we look at just the donors who gave more than $1,000. Here, blue means zero. Not a single person in that block group gave over $1,000. And light green, I have to say the numbers here means one to two. And so you see that this map is basically completely blue. It shows that there were practically no people in this entire area that were able to give that amount of money. And again, we see some improvement when we look at who gave more than 175, but we also see a key where we don't reach most of the numbers that are represented there. So we're still seeing a lot of no one giving more than $175. And a little bit of a handful of people, again, per block group, and nobody giving any more than that. And then it looks completely different when we look at people who gave between $1 and $175, just as we saw with the city as a whole. When we look at this particular area, which, you know, again, as I said, is predominantly African American, has a really high population of residents who are below the poverty line or at the poverty line. And we see that they're not just giving. Overwhelmingly, the map is covered with people who are giving, but that they're parts where a lot of people are giving and a lot of people are mobilized and feel like they can actually participate and make a difference and that they won't be drowned out by big money. And so we did this, I'll just go kind of quickly to show you, we did this also in Chinatown, you know, heavily Asian area. Here again, we also see a lot of folks who are living at or below the poverty level. Again, we see the same trend, maybe a little bit less blue, but quite a bit of blue. This is, by the way, this is not the $1,000 level. This is the over 175. We skipped the $1,000 map, which looks worse than this. You can believe me about that. And then here's how it looks once you actually look at between $1 and $175. Again, you see much, much more participation, and not just by one person, but in many areas, areas that overlap significantly with really low-income areas, you see a lot of participation. We did this for Bronx and Upper Manhattan, and not totally by accident. If you go back to one of the earlier maps, you'll see this is a very heavily Hispanic population. In New York City, again, you see tremendous poverty rates. And again, even for over $175, most of the map is blue. No one was able to give over $175. And again, once you look at between $1 and $175, you see not just participation, but participation in significant numbers. So I know I raced through those last maps. If anyone is interested in seeing them in more detail, we actually kind of pasted them out on the glass table that's right by the window. So later on when we break for the reception, you can look at them in a little bit more detail. But I think this really illustrates in a way that's kind of very compelling, especially for folks who live here and who know what the city looks like and know what these areas look like, who is actually giving, not only that we're getting more small donors, but who those people are and how they're very different from the folks that we're used to hearing dominate the political system. And you know, the point of this for New York State, of course, is we looked at the city data, that's what we were analyzing here, but there's no reason to think that maps of New York State in comparable respect wouldn't look similar if we had similar incentives for all of the participants. So thanks so much for your attention. I'll put my moderator hat back on. To Mike Petra to switch gears a little bit and talk about why this is good for the economy and why business should get behind it.
Sure. Thank you, Lisa, and thank you, Brennan Center. Is this on? Do we know? Yeah, it is on. And thank you for sparing me the embarrassment of having to follow Dr. Dukes, because as she was going through her magnificent presentation, I started to sweat in the back of my head. I'm thinking, oh my God, I've got to follow this icon here with my little presentation. So Lisa, you went on and did a terrific job. I represent a group called the Committee for Economic Development. It's a business-led public policy organization. What I'm going to do here today is give you a business perspective on money and politics. I'm going to first start off, after I give a brief promo about CED, start off with a story. A story which became, in 1999, the poster child for what is wrong with the political system, what's wrong with our campaign finance system. Then I'm going to talk about how big money in politics is bad for the economy and ultimately bad for business. And then I'm going to give you a business rationale for why a small dollar match is something that business can feel comfortable with and to support. First, CED, I don't know if those of you know my organization. We are a 70-year-old business-led public policy organization. We have our roots in the 1940s when the Marshall Plan came into being and CED's trustees, business leaders, came together and helped provide the inspiration for the Marshall Plan. Our business leaders come together and put together task forces on many domestic and foreign policy issues and I think add a much needed business perspective to some of those issues. In the late 1990s, CED released a report called Investing in the People's Business. If you remember the 96 elections when there was the sale of the Lincoln bedroom, many of our members were appalled by getting hit up for multiple contributions, and they wanted a way in. As business leaders, they were fed up. They were tired of having to pay a toll to talk to a congressman or a senator. So CED released Investing in the People's Business. Now you got to remember, we're a think tank made up of business leaders, and we weigh in on education issues and the economy, workforce issues, and so we entered the politics debate, the campaign finance reform debate, somewhat naively. After our release, CNN actually covered the release of our report and called it a man bites dog story because business was getting involved in this area. But in the summer of 1999, some of our CEOs started calling us and saying that they were getting letters, personal letters, from Senator Mitch McConnell, then the head of the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee, asking them to resign from CED because of our stand on campaign finance reform. So at first, I quite frankly, I didn't think it would be that silly to put his name to a letter like that. And so at first, we really didn't take it all that seriously. But then these letters became personal notes. Senator McConnell was sending personal notes to CEOs across the country telling them to resign from our board. And then we realized, this is a big story here. And it was exactly what was wrong with the system. It just so happens that later in the summer, we had an editorial board meeting with the New York Times. And we entered that meeting kind of wondering whether or not we should talk to them about this, because we really felt uncomfortable. Our chairman, a guy named Ed Kangas, who was the CEO of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu, who was the chairman of this report, was 10 minutes late for the meeting. So we weren't sure if we should raise this with the editorial board of the New York Times. Ed walks into the meeting, and with one of the McConnell letters, walks in, slams it on the desk, and says, "This is an outrage. In fact, it's extortion." And we had a business leader for the very first time talk about the fact that this is extortion, what Senator McConnell was doing. And indeed, what was implied here, as he sent those notes to business leaders across the country, was that if you continue to play with CED, I'm not going to let you play with me anymore. And you know, I had some people call me up and say, you know, this guy is an important senator to some of our business. You do realize that. And anyway, CED stuck to its guns. We never had one business leader resign from CED because of it. In fact, we recruited business leaders because they were outraged by being put in that position. So it's an important story. It's a case study, if you will, of what's wrong with the political system. Now, let me also walk you through some of the other things that I think that are at play here and why this is bad for it's bad for business. It's bad for the economy. First, I would argue that there is the appearance of corruption or corruption, depending on how you look at it, a political process that promotes perceptions that government policies are open to the highest bidder is not in accord with the basic tenets of a democratic government, nor is it conducive to a strong business environment. If public policy decisions are made or appear to be made on the basis of political expenditures, policy will be suspect. Now, the CED report that we released in 1999 had many of the tenets of the McCain-Feingold legislation. We called for ending soft money contributions, for reforming issue ads, but we also called for a low dollar match of congressional contributions across the country, and I'll get to that in a minute. But getting back to the corruption aspect, I don't need to remind people here in this audience what effect money had to play in this recent economic collapse that we had in 2008 and 2009. If anybody in this room has a question about that, all you have to do is follow the money. So it affects the economy and it affects business. And business leaders recognize that at some level. Now, I'm going to sort of end here and tell you that CED has joined the New York LEAD effort. We're pleased that Bill Donaldson, the former SEC chairman, the CED trustee, has joined the New York LEAD effort. We're working with the Brennan Center. We have some 50 trustees in New York to support the low dollar match. Now, I'm not going to get into talking to you about why it's a good thing, because we've heard that from some of our speakers. But when you talk to business leaders about the political system and the lack of competition that exists there currently, they see that, and you know, again, they're business leaders. Competition is a good thing. It's good for the economy, and it's good for business. And they were appalled, quite frankly, and somewhat naive, but appalled by the fact that these people get reelected time after time after time. And I think what was significant when we approached our business leaders about this issue was that they stepped back and they said, wait a minute, competition's good for the economy, it ought to be good for the political system. That's how you get business leaders engaged around this issue. So as I mentioned, CED is pleased to be part of this effort. You know, some of our members think that business fares better when they compete in the marketplace than in the political arena. That's certainly what we've talked about in the past. And I'm pleased to be a part of this this panel here tonight. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mike, for giving us that really important and different perspective and maybe upending a little bit of conventional wisdom on the business perspective on this issue. So we really appreciate your participation. And turning it over to round us out, I want to welcome, I didn't have a chance to do that earlier, welcome Zephyr Teachout of Fordham Law School, and we're pleased to have you, and I'll turn it over to you.
Great. I'm really thrilled to be here. I teach election law, and basically Brennan Center does half my teaching for me. Whenever there's a question, we say, well, has the Brennan Center thought about it? And if they haven't, probably nobody has. And just the extraordinary work of the Brennan Center, and I've followed Professor Melvin for years. Absolutely love his work and honored to be with both of you. So I'm going to be brief. I'm going to just a law professor hat for 1 minute. This is constitutional. The court will allow it to happen. The most recent signals from the court in McComish, a case after Citizens United, suggested that this kind of matching funds system would be constitutional. I think that's very important. Other kinds of matching fund systems are not, that are triggered by spending, but the low dollar match is. So there's a huge window to drive in here. Should not be a big concern. That's it for law. I'm supposed to be the reasonable professor. I'm not going to be. I think this is the fight. I really do. I think the fight is matching funds, and I think the fight is New York. Tell you one story about why I believe this. I almost ran for Congress in 2005, 2006, in Vermont, not. And so I did in a pretty small state. I did what you're supposed to do. You go talk to people. What do you need to do? Well, first you need to get $100,000 before the press is going to take you seriously. This is not big money, right? So then, okay, how do I raise $100,000? I make a list of 50 people that I know that will give me $2,000. So I want you to go through this process because it's such a radicalizing process for me. Just imagine for a second you're going to run. So we'll call them all John. So I thought about my friend John, because he's rich, and he's very involved in internet fights. He cares a lot about net neutrality. So I found myself thinking about John and his other rich friends, and thinking about things that I had thought about net neutrality. And so I spent a couple days thinking about net neutrality. I promise you, nobody in Vermont had ever approached me about net neutrality. And then I thought about my other friend, John. And my friend, John, cares enormously about gun control. And he and his wife donate a lot in the area of gun control. Well, I don't know how much you know about Vermont politics. It's not a big issue in Vermont. Again, I actually care about gun control. I actually care about net neutrality. But what I found in that first 4 days is that my mind was entirely occupied, oriented towards the concerns of John and John and John and John, none of whom were the constituents that I was thinking about. So if we'd had a matching fund system in Vermont at the time, instead of making a list of those 50 people who might give $2,000, which we're already talking the 1% right there, basically. You probably know the. I would have been thinking, okay, what is an issue that 1,000 Vermonters care about? What about dental care? Or what about credit cards? Or student loan payments? None of which, my wonderful friend John's, friends John, don't think about those things. They're not wrong not to think about them. But it would totally reorient my brain. And so why I care so much about this is that what I see as the function and the purpose of designing a campaign system is to create structures so that those who represent us are thinking as much as possible about all of us equally. and orienting themselves as much as possible to all our interests equally. Now, they may not always agree with us, but they'll at least be thinking about our concerns about teeth and credit cards instead of the concerns of the 1%. So for me, that's why this is the game. Great example we see of that in the response to the financial crisis, not the crisis itself, is, you know, I was involved in lobbying on Dodd-Frank. I think we were outspent in 2 years, a year per day, something like that. The amount of money we spent in a year was the amount of money the banks were spending in a day. I was talking to an old organizer about things like breaking up the banks and the financial transactions tax. And he said, look, the numbers on these are so high, it doesn't matter how we message it, which is unusual for anybody in D.C. to say. But these were, the numbers on, serious banking reform. Didn't happen. And we weren't the only ones who knew those numbers. Members of Congress knew those numbers. They saw the financial transactions tax numbers. This is a great populist issue, especially in response to the crisis. They're not touching it because they're thinking about John and John and John. And John and John and John are thinking about totally different things than the people in their district. Three. Super PACs. I assume there's going to be questions about that. They're a big deal. They're a huge problem. It's not trivial. This doesn't solve that. That said, in most races in the country, our job, and in New York, our job is to create a system where people can get to the level where they're hurt. That's our job. And if there's enough money in the matching fund system so they can be heard in their district, super PACs are a problem. They're a threat. They're a fight. But who is going to run is going to change. How they're going to talk is going to change. And who they're speaking to is going to change. So while we separately try to change the court, the matching funds project can be amazingly important. Fourth and last. I think the New York fight's really important for the country. People know that the system is corrupt, but they don't believe that there's a way to fix it. And I don't know that we have numbers on this, but I don't believe people know what fair elections is, and I believe they don't trust it when they hear it. That if they don't actually have some sense of how the mechanism works, it's like the Clean Skies Act and the Clean Ground Act and every other messaged idea that doesn't sound true. Well, I think the best way to get to public education is through a good old-fashioned street fight. The way that people can learn about how the fair election system works is to have the fight. Have politicians duking it out, accusing each other, explaining it. That works, to me, better than any amount of public education campaign. So I really want to win this one, but I really think it's worth fighting even if we don't.
Thank you so much, Professor Tichow, for the